Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, on American Variety, we often have, you know, it's kind of an unstated theme of people who have an unusual dream or a big goal or big dream that everybody around them tells them is crazy, you know, and just forget about that. Just go be a lawyer or be a nurse or whatever it is, you know, and just don't beat your head against a wall trying to do that, and because it's so unusual or so big or so odd from where they are, right? But often we have guests on the show who had a dream like that and who pursued it against all odds and succeeded. My guest today on American Variety is such a person. Her name is Julie Clark, and she's Captain Julie Clark. She's has been for more than 25 years a pioneer, actually, I guess, I hate to say it, Julie, but more than 30 years, a pioneer in women in aviation, right? So welcome, Julie.
Thank you. Glad to be here, Court.
And so Julie is an acrobatic pilot or aerobatic pilot and has been that for more than 25 years, which is a performer in air shows, right? So if you've been to air shows, and we see them in East Central Florida coming out of Patrick Air Force Base sometimes. And so she's not a military pilot, but she is a pilot who owns a plane and performs in air shows. But more to the point, in terms of her being a guest on our show, she is one of the very first female commercial airline pilots in the country and possibly in the world, I guess. Going back in 1976, she became a commercial airline pilot for Hughes Air West at that time and really broke through a lot of barriers to do it, you know. So, and she's done both those things, been an aerobatic pilot and a commercial airline pilot simultaneously for about 25 years, which is really two jobs, right? So,
high energy jobs.
Yeah, two very demanding jobs. And so, as you'll hear during the course of our show, Captain Clark is a very high energy person, which you know is how she kind of broke through the barrier. She did. I guess she had to hit them hard, right? So,
yeah.
So she's joining.
Have a plan and go with it.
That's great. Yeah. So Julie, if I may call you Julie, is joining us on the phone from Minnesota, and glad you're here with us. So, I just want to say that Captain Clark is a member of the Hall of Fame of Women in Aviation, which is, you know, she's got all kinds of awards and accolades and is in the aviation world is a pretty famous person. So we're trying to do our little bit here to make her a little bit more famous in the world more broadly beyond aviation, right? So anyway, has anybody ever called you, Julie, a modern-day Amelia Earhart? Has anybody ever kind of compared you to her?
People have said that. You think of yourself as the modern-day. I'd like to think I was a modern-day more like, say, Jackie Cochran or someone. I'm not a big fan of Amelia Earhart. I think she just had a great PR department.
Oh, really?
Like Jackie Cochran, who formed our Women Air Force Service Pilots. To me, she really was a great aviator that did a lot of great things.
Okay. I think I've heard the name. And now, again, aviation is kind of a closed world, you know, so there are people who are extremely well-known in aviation but whose names aren't household names, you know, except a few people like Chuck Yeager and so on. And In fact, you've been named, I noticed, one of the top 40 living legends of aviation a couple different times, along with people like Chuck Yeager and Gene Cernan, an astronaut. You know, so.
Right. In fact, Gene Cernan is a very good friend of mine, as is Chuck Yeager. He's my neighbor in California. So I'm very good friends with both those gentlemen, and we get together every January. So it's always fun to see them both.
So here's the thing. You became a pilot back at a time, and I remember this, you know, when the women on the crews of commercial aircraft were all in the back serving drinks and food. You know, it was kind of the Hollywood tagline was, you know, coffee, tea, or me, or something like that. And
that's, you know, that's right.
They weren't up front driving the bus, right? So,
right.
So being a pilot for a woman was virtually unheard of at the time. What possessed you? How did you decide to do it, and what did you do?
Well, my dad was a commercial airline pilot as well, and I'm one of three daughters, having a twin sister and an older sister. And the first time I actually took a flight with my dad, I was about 8 years old, and my mom let me out of school for one day to do a day trip with him. It was, back then it was Pacific Airlines, actually came from Southwest Airways, formed in 1946, and my dad was one of the original 30 pilots that formed that airline in Long Beach, California, so they were known as the Dirty 30.
Uh-huh.
So just to give you a little history of just the way, the real early parts of Southwest/Pacific Airlines. And so when took a ride with him and flew with him, and he had to sneak me up in the cockpit. Not that that was any big deal, because they weren't locked doors, and some of the airplanes he flew just didn't even have a door. And it was just a lot of fun, and I just thought, wow, this is really cool. I remember thinking, my dad has such a neat job. I mean, he doesn't have to go work in an office. He works in an airplane, and I just think the airplanes, I just had this thing about airplanes from the time I took my first trip with my dad. And my actual first flying lesson in the late 60s was my first time was ever in a small airplane was my first flying lesson. So I never had gotten to fly ever in a small airplane until I started my own flying lessons.
Well, so you really kind of do owe it all to your dad because he got you turned on at an early age. And that's what so often happens with people when a young person just really gets focused on something, then it really makes things simple, right? But it made things simple in the sense that you knew what you wanted to do, but it didn't make things simple in the sense of getting there, right?
Right. Back in the 60s and 70s, women were not airline pilots, and there were not really very many women pilots to begin with, just flying privately, I don't believe.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. You know, it was rare all around. But so I'd say being a woman was only one of the barriers you faced, and that was big enough, right? But there's another thing, and I don't want to embarrass you, but you were also a beautiful woman, and from pictures I've seen, still are today, right? So you had won beauty contests in California, and you were the classic California blue-eyed, blonde, good-looking girl. And so that, you know, that doesn't sound like a... Go ahead.
I don't know. Yeah, that's true. I got kind of hornswoggled to run for this Miss San Carlos, which is my hometown, and it was for a PR, a promotional thing for my aunt and uncle, but for my uncle who had a real estate business. But anyway, next thing I know, I won the contest, and I was like, oh my gosh. So for a whole year, I was Miss San Carlos. But I had also then be forced, if that's the word, that you were required to be in other contests throughout the year. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, I don't want to be doing this. But that was during my college years.
Yeah, so I didn't want to embarrass you by saying that, but I think it's clear to anybody who remembers those days that I would imagine that would even more, beyond your being a woman, that would make pilots tend to kind of objectify you and view you as a sex object, right? And not take you as seriously as they might, let's say, a plain-looking woman or more like a tomboy type or something, you know? And so it would kind of exaggerate in their mind the fact that you were a woman, right? So it might have made it even harder. I mean, did pilots in the early days hit on you and that kind of thing?
Sometimes they did, because we certainly didn't have anything like the sexual harassment things of going on today. I mean, not even close.
And no.
I was on the Joan Rivers show back in the early 90s, and I wore my airline uniform because they asked me to, and she said, you're so little. How do you fly those big planes? And I said, well, Joan, I don't pick them up. I just fly them. And so that started the whole bantering on her show, because she's such a character to begin with, and she's not a big person either, so I'm also very petite. I mean, I'm not a big person, but... I told her, you know, I just fly them. I don't pick them up. But still, I did fly in the military as a civilian instructor in T-34s, and sometimes pushing and pulling and towing airplanes, I'd always have to get somebody to help me because I couldn't do it by myself. So.
Oh, I didn't realize you were a military instructor.
Right. Back in 74, 75, right before I got on with the airlines, it was one of my jobs I had. I was on a contract, 18-month contract. Instructing in T-34s, which just happens to be the airplane I now own and have owned for 33 years, but fly in air shows.
Yeah, that's often a route, you know, maybe even the most common route into a commercial pilot seat is to come from a military background as a pilot, so that helps.
But back then, they didn't even have female naval aviators yet. They didn't come on the scene until 1978, and by that time, I was already well into my airline career. So that was an oddity just in itself, because I was instructing in T-34s for the military, and most of them it was like a plowback where guys were coming back after not flying for at least a set of orders, and then they wanted to get back into flying, and so they started back in the T-34, and I ran that program out at Navy Lemoore, NAS Lemoore.
Yeah, so you were pretty close to being unique, I would say.
Right, and I was married to a naval aviator, an A-7 pilot, so I'd say he helped me get the job as far as my connection to the Navy was through him.
Oh, that's good. Okay. Yeah. So I would say that, you know, those were two barriers then, you know, obviously the big one of being a woman, and then the second one of being somebody who is very good looking, right? You know, I'd say a lot of management types and pilots might tend to view you more as, you know, decorative or take you not seriously. And so maybe that didn't happen so much as I might think, but I bet it happened to some extent, and maybe you didn't even see it or hear it a lot of times, right? But
yeah, I really didn't. I heard it more from passengers, or if I was eating somewhere or somewhere in my uniform out in the public. And I was with the airlines for 28 years, and I upgraded after 6.5 years. So my last 22, 23 years, I was a captain, and it just seemed like people would question that as well. And then they'd say, you're a captain? Hmm. I'd say, yes, ma'am, I am, or sir. And they'd say, on the big jets? And I'd say, yes. Well, what kind of jets do you fly? And, you know, the minute I'd say Airbuses or MD-80s, then they realized I was saying it like it was. But it was so funny how, and people still ask me that now that I'm retired, Well, did you fly the big airlines, the big jets? And I think, you know what? My people think it's harder to fly a big jet.
Yeah.
Actually, the smaller the airplane, usually the harder to fly. They're more squirrely.
Yeah, and the big ones are more electronic.
To this day, still, they're just amazed, and it's, you know, 2009.
Yeah. That's funny. It just shows how little people know, I guess. You know, I mean, flying a jet is probably as easy as driving a car as far as the physical strength aspect of it, you know.
Right. The thing about a jet or an airplane, you just have to learn the systems. And every airplane is different, just like your car. But it's a numbers thing, and it's learning the systems and, you know, decision-making. That's definitely the big thing. And then, well, just like this thing with Sullenberger, Sully, who landed on the Hudson, and that was in the same kind of airplane I retired on.
Oh, yeah.
But now there's a guy who just did everything right, and decision making and being in command and saying this is what we're doing is behind what's behind this job, and you have to be able to do that. And if you can't make decisions or you know, conduct yourself in a way, then you're really not maybe a good candidate to fly airplanes. So it's not for everybody, but it's like a police officer. I probably wouldn't be very good at that because I'm strong and I keep myself very physically fit for my air show flying, but I'm not a big person. So it just depends on whatever, you know, whatever career you choose. You usually need to be pretty good at it if you're going to make it in this world.
I imagine it is true of being a pilot that you can go all your whole career and things are just routine and, you know, you're almost fighting boredom to some extent. But then there's that one moment in a career where suddenly you're on the spot and you have to make a split second decision that will either save or kill a couple hundred people. and that's where you earn your entire career's pay right there in that moment, right?
Exactly. So. And you go through all this in training all the time in the simulator, and you don't want to bend any metal as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember I parked my last Airbus at my last gate, you know, on my last flight, and I remember they're guiding me in, and I was just so happy as I hit the jetway there, not literally, but, you know, stopped there at the jetway gate, and I thought, wow, what a great career, and nobody ever got hurt.
That's
because
fantastic.
You do think about that a lot. I mean, you've got 180 people behind you that depend on you.
Sure. Well, how did the... You know, you mentioned that the passengers would sometimes be flabbergasted that you were this little girl flying that big plane. But
so often. I mean, probably every trip.
Yeah, and so I guess you just kind of let it go in one ear and out the other. You know, you got used to it. But how about the flight attendants, which at the time were called stewardesses, right? So all the gals in the back, how did they react to you? Did they view you as?
They were always very supportive, and the male flight attendants as well.
Mm-hmm.
I will say that. My first year flying with the airlines, my very first year, the reception with them was sometimes better than I was a co-pilot back then, a first officer, than the captain I'd be flying with. Because sometimes the captains made, you know, comments like, oh, it's another empty kitchen, you know.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, so I would just let it be water off my back. But some of the comments were pretty rude sometimes.
That is rude. My gosh.
Yeah. So I would just laugh and say, oh, no. When I'm home, it's still empty because I don't know, you know, for me, it's microwaves. You know, that was the best thing that was ever invented.
Uh-huh. Oh, I know it. So that's good. So the female flight crews didn't make it harder for you, which you'd think in a sense they might have. You know, it's possible that they would be resentful of that, or it would sort of reflect badly on them in their minds or something. So I'm glad that they took the high road and supported you.
Yeah, and I started out as a flight attendant right out of college. I had a degree in Spanish. And I became a flight attendant because you had to have a second language if you wanted to fly overseas.
Hmm.
And I didn't do that for very long, but because of my college, I flew for TWA. It was based in New York. And it was a great job. I have girlfriends that we all went through training together, and we're still friends to this day. There's four of us in particular we get together every 5 years from all different parts that we live in the United States. And one of them still flies for what is now Delta, but was Northwest, and she even flew with me on my last trip.
Wow.
And saying to everybody, you know, our nickname is the Hawkers, but she flew with me on my last flight and let everybody know that here is Captain Clark flying her last flight, but she had been with me since we were 20-some years old in training with TWA. And so I think a lot of the flight attendants supported me because, first of all, I treated them with respect for what they do.
Sure.
And I may be the command of this airplane, and this is the safety briefing we're going to do.
Hmm.
But other than that, let's have a good time on this trip. We'll fly by the book, but let's really have a good time. And I just treated them the way I wanted to be treated as well.
And also you came up through the ranks and kind of, you know, paid your dues.
Out sometime during the trip, if we had dinner together or something, it would come out. I usually didn't bring that up unless we were socially interacting.
You're listening to American Variety Radio with your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Captain Julie Clark, who is truly a pioneer in aviation and one of the first female commercial airline pilots in the U.S. and probably the world, and is also an aerobatic performer, and we're going to get to that in a minute. But, you know, I talked to Julie about the other barriers that you faced, you know, as a woman and as a sort of beauty contest winner and, a you know, an atypical-looking, well, you know, you're a good-looking woman, right? So anyway, that was maybe a secondary barrier there. I keep saying that, don't I? But anyway, multiple compliments, I don't know. But I would say a third barrier is maybe a psychological barrier, or would be for many people, and that involves a very tragic incident that occurred with your father, who you mentioned earlier was an airline pilot himself and kind of got you started in your passion for this field. So you want to tell that story and what happened?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, we were a great family of five, my sisters and my mom and dad. And in 1963, my mom died of an accidental death, a choking accident. Mm. And so now all of a sudden my dad was forced to be a father of three teenage daughters.
Wow.
And he was chief pilot of the airline at the time, at Pacific Airlines.
Unreal.
And he just loved to fly. My dad, I feel like I really do carry that gene where he just loved to fly. On his days off, he'd go to the airport and say, "Who wants to go to the field with me? I'm going to go pick up my paycheck." You know, "I'll go, Dad. I'll go with you." And he just loved the airline he flew for. He was so respected, and he was also the most senior pilot there, and was to be the first when he reached that magic age of 60. He would have been the first, if they had kept the airline little, to retire. So people sometimes even called him Dad because he was the father of the airline.
Yeah.
But on this particular flight that I'll be telling you about, which is so tragic, he actually took the flight because some pilot called in sick. So he called our neighbor across the street and said, "Hey, you know, somebody just called in sick at the airline, and I think I'll just take this trip tonight because it's just up to Reno, San Francisco, Stockton, Reno, turn around, come back the next day, Stockton, back to San Francisco." And so he thought, "Well, I'll be home even before the girls get home from school." Like, he'd be home around noon.
Hmm.
So he called Polly Gerasi, who was our neighbor, who her husband was our family doctor, and we were all real close on this little street on Knoll Drive in California. So he decided to take the trip. And that would be normally a routine deal. But on this particular trip, he was shot by a 27-year-old passenger who had marital problems and money problems and psychological problems, obviously, too. And actually, he went up on my dad's flight to Reno. He got up there, and then he lost a lot of money gambling and actually flew back on my dad's flight the next day. And to him, he probably didn't even take note who the crew was. But anyway, during that flight on the last segment from Stockton, where they had dropped off passengers and then filled the airplane back up completely full to San Francisco in an F-27, that's the type of airplane, he barged into the cockpit, which was a door but no lock, and he just started shooting, and he shot my dad dead with a 357 Magnum. I've never been into guns, but I know it's a very powerful gun.
Mm.
And luckily, they were flying above an undercast, so when the airplane crashed, he was thinking, well, if I do this over the bay, the San Francisco Bay, they'll never solve this accident. But he didn't know where they were because they had clouds below them.
Hmm.
But he was east of San Francisco in the San Ramon Danville area, which is like a bedroom community of San Francisco Bay. But the plane ended up going down. The co-pilot was struggling with the gunman. Voices were heard to the extent of something like, "Skipper shot, I'm trying to help." It was kind of the garbled message.
Mm.
But after all was said and done, and the flight data recorder was, you know, recovered, but when the airplane hit, it stayed aloft for about 11, 12 more minutes, going up and down and just all over because it didn't have an autopilot.
Mm.
And when it finally hit, it hit straight in. I mean, actually measured on the seismograph at Stanford University as an earth tremor.
Wow.
Because there was just nothing left of it. And here I am now, 15 years old, and I actually demanded that I go to the crash site with my relatives who came out, you know, when this horrible accident happened, and it's still so vivid in my mind, and I'm 61 now.
Yeah.
But to make a long story short, it was very tragic, and, you know, now all of a sudden my sisters and I were orphaned, but my hero was gone, and, you know.
Wow. So, I mean, that would have been, in a sense, that would have been the end of your forward motion toward a really productive professional life anyway for a lot of people, and especially
I was just devastated.
Yeah, especially
and,
girls.
Locked cockpit doors, you know, became a law 4 years later, and it's still to this day called the Clark Law.
Is it?
Clark Act, I mean.
Is
that named after Captain Ernie Clark.
Wow.
But it was a very sad thing, and people, and then I'll tell people this, or it comes out, or it's been written, oh, your dad was hijacked. I said, no.
Mm.
Hijacking came in the late 60s, and that was when people were commandeering jets to Cuba.
Yeah.
But when you hijack something, it's because you're taking that airplane, and you want to take it where they don't want to go.
Yeah.
And you're threatening people's lives, but this was just a selfish act where this guy should have just shot himself in the head on the ground, wherever. So he killed 44 people. So, it, you know, the big headlines in the San Francisco Chronicle and the Examiner and headlines all over the world, Court, I cannot tell you, it was huge news, huge, because it was the first ever in the history of commercial aviation ever where the crew had been shot at the controls or disabled an airplane that made the airplane come down.
Unbelievable story. So there you were at 15, an orphan. And so that's what I was kind of getting at sideways, was that for many people, the last thing they would want to do would be to make a living in an airplane. And yet, you know, you got, in a sense, you got back up on the horse. And,
right.
You know, and so it didn't stop your love and your passion of flying that your father had instilled in you. But that would have been a barrier for a lot of people, you know. But again, it just shows the determination and drive you have. I keep complimenting you, don't I?
I just still wanted to fly. I mean, all I kept thinking was, how am I ever going to do this? I love flying. And even after he was gone and I'm in, still finishing high school and then going, I was so lucky that Bank of America sent me to college. So I was able to go to college. And because I just kept up my grades, you know, a lot of people, you know, nowadays, maybe kids would just drop out of school. And back in the 60s, you never dropped out of school. That wasn't even an option.
Mm-hmm.
But I just was determined to do something with my life. And very shortly after that, I had already been accepted to go to live down in Chile for a year as an exchange student. And I didn't really want to do that now because I had just lost my parents. And so it was my neighbors that said, you need to go, Julie. You need to do that. You've already got it set. And I'm really glad I did that as well.
Mm.
Although my first couple months, I was so depressed and so lonely and, you know, struggling with the language. And it's funny, when you go live in a foreign country, then all of a sudden you almost wake up one day and you don't even have to think about what you're saying. You just say it. So it's funny how I finally adapted. But I came back more, I thought, more mature. And in college, I thought, well, I want to do something with this foreign language, but I really didn't know how the flying was going to fit in. That just kind of evolved as I saw things turn around in my life. And the minute there was an opportunity to do something, like take flying lessons, I was still flying for that now World Airways, but I would take leaves of absences. And I'd wait tables at night at Charlie Brown's restaurant in South San Francisco. And then I got involved in a water ski. I had water skied in shows down in Alabama when I was teaching. I did teach school for 1 year, and that was like the world's worst job. And I always ask people when I give motivational speeches, how many people here are educators? And when they raise their hand, Court, I say, you are my hero. Because that is such a horribly hard, I won't say horrible job, it's just a very difficult job and very underpaid and I think unrespected. That's very hard. And I taught middle school. But down in Alabama where I was teaching school, I learned to water ski in ski shows for the Army. And so now I'm back in California, and I went and tried out at Marine World. And next thing I know, I was skiing for Marine World for almost 4 years and waiting tables at Charlie Brown's and then taking flying lessons in the mornings from 6:30 to 10. And then I had to go ski at Marine World. Then I get off about 2 o'clock, and then I go wait tables from 7 until 2 a.m., and then 4 hours later, I'd be back up taking another flying lesson. So where there's a will, there's a way.
There is, and there's a way here where we are on American Variety Radio talking with Captain Julie Clark about her pioneering career in aviation. We have just a few minutes left, but I want to switch, Julie, to talking about your other career, which is also a demanding thing that you've been doing for at least 25 years now, where you're an aerobatic pilot. So just tell us just kind of briefly about that, and what do you fly, and who's your sponsor, and do you travel a circuit and things like that?
Right. I'm an air show performer. This is my 31st season, so I've been doing this for 31 years. And I'm doing it in an old restored military trainer, which ironically is what I flew in the Navy. And I bought it a long time ago on a government surplus bid when I really shouldn't have because I had no money to pay for it. But back then I paid only $18,000 for it, and now it's several hundred thousand dollar airplane.
Wow, good investment.
And I've been flying air shows since my very first air show in 1978. And I turned it into a business in 1980. I flew on a team for 3 years as a team, and we were known as the Falcons, and now I've been solo since 1980. And I'm very proud to say I fly for Chevron Global Aviation. That's my corporate sponsor. And I really invite anyone to go to my website, which is AmericanAerobatics.com, all one word, and aerobatics, A-E-R-O-B-A-T-I-C-S, not aerobics.
Yeah, okay.
So I do that in the morning, too. So it's AmericanAerobatics.com, and we'll tell you all about myself and my airplane and my story. I also have a biography book out. It's been out now for about 4 years called Nothing Stood in Her Way, Captain Julie Clark. And through my website, you can buy that from me direct, or you can go to Amazon.com. But anyway, I really want to thank Chevron Global Aviation because they keep me flying. It's a great company. It's a company with all kinds of opportunity, integrity, and I'm just so proud to be a part of Chevron products, Chevron Global Aviation.
Well, we do have, a couple of minutes left. So when you're at an air show, what do you do in a nutshell? I mean, is it just you, or is it a flight of planes that are with you, or is it just you doing your thing? And if so, what is that thing? What do you do?
Okay, that's a good question, because you're right. People are going to think, well, what do you mean? First of all, when I restored my airplane, I'll give a little bit of a background here. I was an Air Force trainer, and even though I flew the B models, which were the Navy trainers, this was an Air Force trainer. I bought it up in Elmendorf Air Force Base up in Anchorage. Flew it home to L.A., and I knew my husband and my Navy pilot husband. We were both out of now the Navy, and I'm flying now for Golden West Airlines, soon to be Hughes Air West, and making $475 a month, so we both were pretty broke.
Wow.
But I ended up restoring this airplane myself. Took 4.5 years, and it did cause a divorce. That was definitely the last nail in the coffin. We both had airline careers, and then I'm spending all this time restoring this airplane. But I restored it to the colors of Air Force One, and so I went to the library and took out this book called The Flying White House, did all my own paint job and design of the airplane, so it has said United States of America on it now for 31 years. So back in the early 80s, when I was flying air shows, I'd fly to music. I used to fly to Chariots of Fire. And then for a while I flew What a Wonderful World with Louis Armstrong. And then in 1983, I got involved with God Bless the USA, the song by Lee Greenwood, who is now a personal friend of mine. I have the rights through him to fly to the song, even though it's now owned by MCA Records. But he even endorsed my biography book, Lee Greenwood did. Yeah. But to this day, I still fly to the same song. It's very patriotic. It's choreographed to that song. And now, in light of where we are in this world with all these fighting for freedom and terrorists, the song still fits really well. And sometimes I tell people, maybe I should change my show and maybe fly to another song. And I've had people say, you do that and I'm not going to come watch you fly anymore. But it's done with patriotic music, red, white, and blue smoke, wingtip smoke, so blue and red and white smoke, exhaust white smoke, and fireworks throughout. I have a ground crew that drives my big rig throughout the United States, Canada, Mexico, Caribbean. We go all over the circuit, and we do approximately 15 to 20 shows a year.
So, Julie, can people go to AmericanAerobatics.com, your website, and see the schedule for your shows and see if they're going to be near them?
Right.
Okay.
In fact, we've done 2 shows already this year in Florida, at Jacksonville and Lakeland Sun and Fun. And then we went to Vidalia, the Onion Fest.
Well, again, your biography, Nothing Stood in Her Way, Julie Clark. You can find that online, and it's available through Barnes & Noble and other outlets, probably Amazon.com. Julie, I want to thank you so much for being on with us here to talk about your pioneering career in aviation, and you're still obviously a ball of fire and going strong, so thank you so much for being on as our guest.
It's my pleasure, Corey. It's really nice getting to know you as well.
You too, and thanks to all of you for listening out there. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.